Honestly, I wasn't sure we could pull this off ourselves.
You had the vision, and Blinds.com brought your dreams to life.
Yeah, their custom window treatments and free design consultation. Total game changer. Ava walked us through everything. Styles, colors, what would work best in this space.
And we didn't have to leave the house. Free samples showed up fast, and they made it super easy to compare and choose.
Right? Plus, no high-pressure sales pitch, just smart guidance. And the install? I thought it'd be tricky. But Blinds.com instructions were clear. Everything fits perfectly.
And thanks to their SureFit guarantee, if something doesn't fit, they remake it for free. Talk about peace of mind.
And it costs way less than having a designer to our house or going to one of those overpriced showrooms.
We saved money, got the exact look we wanted, and we did it ourselves.
We did it.
So, kitchen windows next?
Blinds.com makes buying and installing window treatments easy and affordable because nobody covers windows better than Blinds.com. Black Friday deals are going on all month long. Save up to 45% off site-wide, plus an additional 10% off every order at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions apply.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit detecttheSOS.com today to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Lengwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. What a last 2 days are so beautiful when you compare them to the weather we've had for, seems like forever beforehand, all the rain and storms, etc., but the day becomes even better when you're able to share love with someone, no matter the weather. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. It's titled, Open Your Mind and Heart with Love. Jesus watched and listened as three gentlemen sat and shared some bread with him. One said to him, Master, we have told you what is on our mind. Now it's time for you to tell us what's on yours? Jesus nodded in agreement and said, It is good to share not only bread, which is the staff of life, but also what is in the mind and heart. Each of us has been given a gift. And when we share that gift, we are truly blessed. A second man said to Jesus, Master, I've often thought about those who have lived before us, about the truths handed down to them and the truths they have passed on to us. Will that chain ever be broken? No, my friend. There will always be people who can teach and inspire others. A day will come when people will grow in knowledge and travel all over the world, touching every land and every body of water. Humankind will fill the clouds and understand more about the sun, the moon, and the stars. Just as we understand more clearly what was written a long time ago, so too, those in the future will see the Father's gifts in a new light. As humanity spreads over the face of the earth, so too will knowledge of the Father increase. A third man asked, Master, do you think we understand the Father's words as well as those to whom they were first given? Jesus smiled and said, Some do, but some never will. For unless people open their mind and heart with love to the Spirit, they will not understand the Father's words. A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes at the beginning of the introduction to his latest book titled Transhumanism and the Image of God, subtitled Today's Technology and the Future of Christian Discipleship. In the early 1960s, Hanna-Barbera produced its page-age counterpart to its animated sitcom hit The Flintstones. While that show had been set in the distant past, the studio set this new show, The Jetsons, in the distant future, the early 2060s. The Jetsons live in Orbit City with its houses, stores, and office buildings rising into the sky on pillars. Robots clean and crack one-liners. Family life is filled with the same gaffes that make up your normal sitcom. But technological advances, and sometimes malfunction, provide fun distractions. Even though we see that the Jetsons got a lot wrong, we're constantly tempted to think about technology this way. Gadgets will continue to evolve, but humans will stay basically the same. Michael Best calls this the Jetsons fallacy, and argues that it pulses through many influential sci-fi visions of the future. Alien species and intelligent robots coexist right alongside unmodified humans, who grapple with challenges and often emerge as the heroes. And yet, this is a fallacy, because radical technological change will radically shape humans as well. As Best puts it, the only problem with his comforting picture of the future is that it is probably not true. We are headed into a social order whose most salient new feature may well be the systematic modification of human bodies and minds through incredibly powerful means. The process is already underway today and seems unlikely to slow down in the decades to come. The prevalence of the Jetsons fallacy suggests that many people in contemporary society are living in a state of denial, psychologically unprepared for what is actually far more likely to be coming their way. In other words, technology changes us, so our future probably isn't one where humans are exactly the same and robots just come along beside us. The change will be deeper. A Christian version of the Jetsons fallacy would go something like this. Discipleship is about following Christ, and we can direct any technology toward that end rather easily. As long as we avoid obvious sin, don't use your smartphone to watch pornography, for instance, technology will continue to be a blessed add-on to the life on earth. To the life of faith. But one futurist puts the problem with this idea very simply. Quote, humans were always far better at inventing tools than using them wisely. Close quote. Thinkers such as Best would say that this Christian version fails to grapple with the potential for technology to change radically the way we think about what it means to be human, and what sort of future we hope for. The author of these words are Dr. Jacob Schatzer. He is assistant professor and associate dean in the School of Theology and Missions at Union University. He is an ordained Southern Baptist minister and the author of A Spreading and Abiding Hope, editor of a volume of essays by A.J. Conyers, an assistant editor for Ethics and Medicine. He has received his PhD from Marquette University. Dr. Jacob Schatzer, welcome to Amplify.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I loved your book. Again, I guess maybe people are up to date on some of these things. I guess I've been more traditional, especially in what I do on this program. But when I got a copy of this book and it said Transhumanism and the Image of God, Today's Technology and the Future of Christian Discipleship. I said, I have to read that and then determine if indeed you were guests I'd like to have on. And 100% I am, because even as my story said, it probably speaks of you. My friend, there will always be people who can teach and inspire others. A day will come when people will grow in knowledge and travel all over the world and on and on. So thank you for being with us. What can we learn just by about your book, just from reading the title, Transhumanism and the Image of God?
Yeah, well, I think the main thing that comes across in the title is I'm trying to draw on something that Christians, many Christians probably think they're not interested in, and show how something that we know is important, the image of God, can help us rethink that or understand it in a new way. Most Christians think that transhumanism is just something, you know, maybe that's in movies or that scientists are thinking about or something, but something that they're not really concerned with. And so it provides an interesting entry point for us to talk about these issues of technology and what it means to be human and things like that.
And I think by the end of this program, people listening are going to be concerned and interested in what you have to say in this book. And you set it up. I like the way you set it up, but some things we just take for granted from the past because we live with them for so long. And you talk about time and space and what we have already learned from history might help us to look at today and say, where might we be going in the future? And you distinguish clock time, natural time, and religious time. Why is that important?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm trying to do in that introduction that you read from is basically start where I think most Christians start, which is that technology is not that big of a deal. We can learn how to use it well, and as long as we use it in a good way, there's nothing to be concerned about. And so I think that is a fallacy, as I brought out in that portion that you read, but then I turned to this issue of time as a way to kind of illustrate that. We kind of take time for granted. What time is it? We think is a fairly simple question. Most of us would respond with an hour and a minute. But actually, the very way that we answer that question, what time is it, shows the way that technology has changed the way that we think about time and experience time. So we very quickly think about clock time. Usually if somebody asks you what time it is, you know that's what they mean. They want to know what your watch or your phone says. But really when you go back further in the past, when that kind of precision in timekeeping wasn't possible, you see that there are these other ways of thinking about and relating to time. Natural time being related to seasons or the sun and the moon. Religious time, obviously, being related to the liturgical year and the learning that we get from that. And so this issue of time, I just was trying to draw out something that we take for granted. We think that what time is it is such a simple question, but in fact, it's a question that is technologically loaded in a way, and technology pushes us to think about time in different ways.
And some of the examples you give, I'm just going to jump around in your book. There's so much I could talk about. You write in a 1967 essay, E.P. Thompson argues that mechanical clocks altered factory work in England by restructuring work habits and similarly encouraging an inward notion of time. This restructuring, quote, led individuals to accept the Industrial Revolution's basic premises of quantifiable wage labor and systematic production, close quote. Mechanical time changed the way workers viewed time and the value of their labor. It hit them in the wallet. And later you write, the development of standardized clock technology has made it possible to measure and value standardization. As late as 1830, rebellious popular classes in Paris attacked clock towers all over the city because clock time was used to oppress them. Clock time is embedded in power relationships, in property relations, in work relations. The mechanical clock was not merely a neutral tool, but one that encouraged and made possible certain ways of viewing and experiencing the world. And that's what we're facing again today, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's something that we've faced in various ways.
Yes.
As different technologies shape the way we experience and view reality. And so really this illustration of time that I draw out in the introduction is just meant to draw to our attention that in one sense, when we're looking at transhumanism and we're looking at digital technology and we're looking at smartphones, it is in a long line of technologies that have changed us. So the first step that I want to take is to help people say, wait a second, we should expect these technologies to shape the way we experience the world and shape the way we live our lives in the world, shape the way we worship God in the world and seek hope and a future, just to begin to help us see that this is not something new. Though later in the book, as you know, I actually do think there is something new about the particular temptations that we face today.
Right, and you point out how time reveals what has greater value in our lives, and that's going to happen today, too, with the advance of technology in so many ways. The quote, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When you've got a smartphone with a camera and the availability to post something online, everything looks like a status update. And you write, tools aren't neutral. Rather, they encourage us and shape us towards certain goals, and they often do so in hidden ways. If we have different goals, the disciples of Christ most certainly do, then we must not take for granted the power that tools have, especially immersive tools, in redirecting the goals we are already devoting ourselves to. So technology, you point out, doesn't determine our future, but it also isn't silent. And so that's what it means, that it's far from neutral, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the first, I mean, if my book only does one thing, I hope that it shakes people out of that easy answer of technology is simply neutral. As long as we choose to do good with it, it'll be good. If we choose to do bad with it, it'll be bad. It's not neutral, though. Even when we're choosing to do good things with it, the possibilities that technology provides, the shape of life that technology encourages, all those things are turning around and impacting us in ways that aren't neutral, because they're ways that are circling around the very meaning of what it means to be human and what it means to live a life of human flourishing, what it means to live a life before the face of God.
Yeah, you point out that technologies are shaping us, and shaping people is another way of talking about discipleship. Is there a sense, then, that we are blind to the way technology shapes us?
Yeah, I think in many ways we are, and because it just seems so natural to use our tools in the way that they seem to be meant to be used. It doesn't, you know, when smartphones first became more popular, and then there's the ability to post pictures more frequently, or to update our statuses more frequently and share things. It just seemed like an unmitigated good and an exciting thing. And so we didn't, many people didn't realize, well, actually there's more going on here. And so I think that there are good things about technology, and we can easily see so many of them. And sometimes we easily see those things and we miss some of these other things.
I didn't quite even understand this until I thought about it. When you write that legal theorists are beginning to grapple with whether a smartphone contains so much personal data and information that it merits protections similar to your private thoughts. Wow, that goes very deep there at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think many of these questions are just beginning to emerge. And even in the time since I wrote this and sent it off to be, typeset and published,
yes,
and all the time that happens with that, you know, many of these things have advanced far beyond what I even discuss in the book.
And so you point out, we are not evolving as human beings. We are upgrading just like software.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one way to talk about it.
And every technology will alienate you from some part of your life. We can expect that. And that people won't wouldn't tend to look at that, I would think, until it's pointed out to them, until there is some examination of conscience, of their own being, to determine what it is that motivates them, what it is that's important to them, what it is that is influencing them. And so you speak about we need techno-moral virtues to choose a future worth wanting. Amplify on that a little bit. Techno-moral virtues.
Yeah. So this idea of techno-moral virtues, isn't original to me. This actually is coming from someone writing from an atheistic or non-faith perspective anyway. And this idea of techno-moral virtues is the idea that we need virtues. We need to develop the ability to see and love and choose the good when it comes to technology. We need to develop an understanding of what a good life is and how to pursue that good life and use technology when appropriate in that attempt, but not become so consumed by our technology that we allow the form of technology itself to kind of set what that is. If we're going to use mm-hmm. technology ethically, we have to have something outside of technology to point us in the right direction and shape us.
Yeah, you point out that there are two different ways in which the term technology can be used, but it's the digital technologies that can form us with a particular form of human flourishing, and that there are two philosophical movements tied closely to the promises of technology, and that technology seems to be without limitations. I don't want to get to the. I have this question that you pose that I don't. Let me pose it, and we'll get to it after the break. Is it conceivable that someday my consciousness will be able to be uploaded into a computer? We're going to take this break, and then we'll be back. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest this evening is Associate Professor and Associate Dean Jacob Schatzer in the School of Theology and Missions at Union University. We're talking about his book, Transhumanism and the Image of God. We live in an age where technology seems to be without limitations. And the question is raised, is it conceivable that someday my consciousness will be able to be uploaded into a computer? And that raises then a second question, does this give rise to the question, what is human and what is not? Professor?
Yeah, so this is one of the really interesting questions with transhumanism and posthumanism is, of course, this kind of sci-fi scenario of people being able to upload their consciousness into a computer and achieve digital immortality. Now, this is one of the most far-reaching scenarios. There are actually much more practical and manageable things that transhumanists and posthumanists are pursuing. This is the one that kind of grabs the attention, right? Because it's yes. the biggest payoff, supposedly. And honestly, right now, scholars and scientists are in disagreement about whether this is even possible, what would be used to achieve it and things like that. Even people who view the human brain as primarily information and who think that we could get all of that information into a digital environment, when you do that, you still have a human biologically alive with a brain and a digital copy. And so, is our consciousness then in that computer, or is there just a copy of all this information? So I think that this is one of those things that's still a ways out there as far as what this challenge might look like for what it means to be human as we learn to digitize more and more of our lives and more of our thoughts. But it's still one that grabs the attention, right? This idea of is this what might make immortality possible?
Yes. One distinction we need to make at the very beginning, maybe I should have made it even sooner. Tell us a little bit about the two philosophical movements tied closely to the promises of technology, because that's what you deal with throughout the book then.
Yeah, so the title of the book includes one of those groups, and that's transhumanism, and then the other is posthumanism. These groups are very closely related. There's also a great deal of diversity within each of them, right? So it's very difficult to really draw the circle perfectly as far as what is what with these groups. But I think the simplest way to begin to do that is to say that transhumanists are a group of philosophers, tech entrepreneurs, body hackers, things like that, who are interested in this idea of moving beyond human limitations. They view any kind of human limitation that we want to overcome as something bad that we should be able to overcome with our creativity and our technology and whatever else. And so they're focused on this process of moving beyond the human. Posthumanists, on the other hand, are kind of focused on that goal, that next phase, what that might be. What is it that comes after humans? And so they're related, right? The transhumanists are focused on the process. The posthumanists are focused on the goal. But that's one way to distinguish the two.
And you're right that you believe it may take 10 to 20 years to know what is really happening. And that's not a surprise when we think about it. If one is not living a healthy eating and living lifestyle, it sometimes comes back. It's in 10, 20 years or more, we find out what really happened, what our behavior, how it was changed. And therefore, we can look at our use of technology might change our brains and therefore our behavior. And of course, as you note, this varies from person to person depending on their tendencies and their temptations. And I like this statement that the way we use tools today changes us for tomorrow. We make them, they make us. So we make them and then they make us. And there are concerns that theologians raise. What are some of the additional concerns that theologians raise?
Yeah, well, I think one of the first concerns that comes up, at least from a Christian perspective, is to just question this whole idea of, is it a good idea to seek to move beyond what it means to be human? Is there something about our limitations that are actually good? Can we get on board with a movement that seeks to move beyond the flesh when we worship a God who took on flesh, right? And so, yes. So one of the very beginning issues theologically is just this question of not just what does it mean to be human, but is human something we should move beyond, or is it not finding our fulfillment as humans being shaped into the image of Christ that is actually the source of hope?
And in 2008, adults spent an average of 18 minutes on their phones per day. In 2015, it's 4 years ago, they were spending 2 hours and 48 minutes per day. And you write, this shift to mobile devices is dangerous because a device that travels with you is always a better vehicle for addiction. And so there's a danger of even addiction here, isn't there?
Yeah. So this is where I had mentioned earlier that at some level, I think that what we're facing is similar to what we've faced in the past, right? Technology brings changes. We see that with the clock in the introduction. But there's also something more pervasive, something more immersive, something more dangerous, I think, when it comes to digital technology because of how quickly we have begun to spend so much more time living our lives through this technology, and the speed of that change, our inability to track quickly what are the good things that are happening with that, what are the bad things that are happening with that. I mean, we're only now beginning to see studies about attention spans, the way that digital technology impacts that, the ability to track an argument or read a book. We're beginning to see the impact it has on children. but we're still only beginning to see these things. So I think that on the one hand, we can see ourselves connected to these challenges of the past, but on the other hand, we really, I think, need to recognize that what we're facing is on a different level because of the intensity of our engagement with this technology and its similarities with patterns of addiction, whether that's substance abuse, drugs, alcohol, things like that. I mean, people are beginning to see similar tendencies when you take someone's smartphone away as someone who's a hard drug user and has those drugs taken away. And so there's just so many levels where these alarm bells are beginning to go off.
And so some of the categories we're talking about and their possible effects are from social networking, identity and relationships, gaming, attention, addiction, and aggression, and search engines, learning, and memory. So that really touches the human being very deeply in various aspects of our being.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the different types of people or people with different interests probably find themselves, hit in different ways with this, right? So some people are not really playing aggressive video games or anything on their smartphone. And so they're not maybe seeing those kind of changes, and others aren't interested in looking up information and using search engines all the time. And so they're not seeing that impact their ability to recall information or process an argument. So I don't think there's probably anyone who hits all of these issues, but rather these are different issues that studies are beginning to show are coming up as we spend more and more time immersed in this type of technology.
And so what we love is what we worship, and you write, simple practices are not innocent, for they form the heart to buy into these visions. Being Christian isn't simply about shaping our thinking in a certain way. If we're going to love the right things, we have to take what we do seriously because it shapes our loves over time. What do you believe can happen to a society that has lost its connection to any sense of the transcendent or any sense of divine calling, for example?
Yeah, well, I think that honestly, this idea of transhumanism is just as good of an answer as any to that question. I mean, I think that when we lose that sense of transcendence, or we lose that notion of God's call on our lives as something that orients us and draws us forward, we just have to fall back on concepts like fairness and do no harm, kind of the classic political liberalism that in many ways helps, but in other ways it just reduces us to agreeing on rules of a game, but not really agreeing on whether the game is basketball or football or baseball or something completely different. When we lose those higher orienting things, we just fall back on these procedural fairness type things. And this is exactly where the transhumanists want to kind of slide in here and say, look, people should have the right to do what they want with their body. If they want to, connect their body to a microchip, they should be able to do that. They're not hurting anybody. There's totally lacking any idea of what it means to be human and what God is calling us to be. And so with that gone, each person gets to chart their own idea of the future and what that might be. And on the one hand, that sounds alluring, but on the other hand, we have to realize that that's actually chaotic and lacks hope, right? Because we don't have hope on our own to chart our own way.
Living a life in response to the call of God, you write, is not the same as grasping control at all costs. And therefore, the sense of true community is threatened. And you write, if we want technology to serve the community, then it must be useful to move people toward an ultimate goal, not defined by technology itself. And so living a life in response to the call of God is not the same as grasping control. What is the difference between the two?
Yeah, so I think that this idea of control is one of the places where we see most clearly the way technology tricks us into its own story, into its own view of what's wrong with the world and how to solve it, right? We tend to think, well, if you're like me, we tend to think more control is better. If something can give me control, that's a good thing. So technology obviously is very good at giving us control over many things. And we think that that's automatically good. But we can easily forget that actually the Christian story is not one of us all gaining our own independent control. Rather, it's a story of us learning to submit ourselves to the will of our Creator, to accept the gift of His Son, to follow after Him, and to be made into His image. It's not to seek our own control, but to trust that God is in control and that we will flourish as we worship and follow Him, not worship and follow ourselves.
We began the program by my asking you about the title of your book, what it tells us about what we're going to discuss. And you have a couple definitions within the book. The transhumanist movement seeks to improve human intelligence, physical strength, and the five senses by technological means. Transhumanism is, quote, humanity taking control of its evolutionary destiny. And you believe, from reading your book, that we are all closer to being transhumanists than we might care to admit. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I think that the reason that that's the case is that transhumanism has all of these values that we actually share, because we don't realize that they're more problematic than they appear to be at first. This, at one level, transhumanism is just enlightenment individualism meets fast computers and powerful pharmaceuticals. You can make your own destiny. You can be your own person. You can chart your own path. And all of these things are available to you to do that as you please, right? Enlightenment individualism holds the individual up to ourselves as an object of worship and ultimate value. And so we buy into these things, and we buy into this notion that we need control. We buy into this idea that technology will automatically make us better. And we still don't think we want our consciousnesses uploaded into a machine. But there are actually a lot more things about transhumanism that we're getting much closer to being on board with than we think.
You've already said it rejects the supernatural and enables us to overcome our biological and genetic inheritance. It transcends what we would currently label quote-unquote human. You write, transhumanism focuses on the ever-changing process of development and growth, while post-humanism focuses on a point beyond the human, as you talked about at the beginning of this hour. Post-humanism means exceeding the limitations that define the less desirable aspects of the human condition. And quote, we don't need to wait for the second coming of Christ in order to overcome death. A couple of geeks and a lab can do it. What are some of the misconceptions, four common misconceptions about transhumanism?
Yeah, so the four common misconceptions about transhumanism, first of all, I mean, many people think that transhumanists are just looking for perfection, right? They're just trying to make everything perfect. But in fact, transhumanism is just rooted in this idea of progress, of continually getting better. And so transhumanists would say, we're not sure what perfect would be. We don't know what the end should look like, but we should strive for it. We should make progress, right? And so really, if we think we're not transhumanists because we know that technology can't make us perfect, transhumanists would say, yeah, we know that too. We're just looking for progress. And progress is something that we all often buy into without thinking. The transhumanists also don't know exactly when posthumanism will occur, right? There's not like a line that transhumanists right. will say, okay, well, let's all get on board and cross this line and become posthuman together. They're much more focused on this process, on the possibilities and things like that. And many also would think that transhumanists just hate the body, right? I even mentioned this earlier when I said that one of the problems is that Christians believe that God took on a body. God took on flesh, right? And Jesus. Well, transcendentalists would say that they don't hate the body. They want to improve and expand what it means to be embodied through technology, and maybe ultimately decide to leave biological bodies, but not necessarily, right? So it's not so clean cut as transhumanism just equals becoming machines. And also, transhumanists fear death. In fact, transhumanists would say that they don't fear death so much as they don't want a painful death. And if they, since they have a materialistic view of reality, they don't really fear ceasing to exist as they see death, but rather they would say, well, let's prolong life. Let's put that off as long as we can. So really, many of these kind of simple ways that we can tend to brush transhumanism aside don't accurately fit with what transhumanists are actually proposing and what they're actually trying to do.
In fact, there is a transhumanist declaration, and you've broken it down into 9 sections, followed by your response. We could spend the rest of the program on that, but I just want people to know there's so much more that we are not able to count even the amount to talk about, even with the amount of time that we have. What is meant by morphological freedom?
Yeah, so in the book, I try to draw on 3 values of transhumanism that I think that we kind of more easily buy into without realizing it. And the first of those is morphological freedom. And morphological freedom just means the ability to do whatever you want with your body. There should be no limitation, no one who prevents you from doing what you want with your body, as long as you're not harming others, right? So this value for transhumanists leads to experimentation with, you know, implanting chips under the skin, or there's even a kind of a seemingly silly example of if you want to have a tail, you should be able to, you know, have a robot tail if that's how you feel and want to express yourself. So for transhumanists, this freedom, this ability to do whatever you want with your body is just a basic human right that flows out of many other basic human rights that we take for granted.
And some of the objections to it is what might people have to this right first? We could argue that individual rights do not remove obligations we have to the broader human community. The second one that you propose is we might argue that morphological freedom will decrease diversity in society as people choose popular alterations that lead to more uniformity. And third, we could argue that morphological freedom might increase class differences as the wealthy are able to adopt them to a greater degree and sooner than the poor. Amplify on those just a little bit for us.
Yeah, so I think, honestly, that third one is the one that always jumps out to me the most as something that I think is a problem from societal perspective, but also just from the perspective of the church, right? That the way, this idea of, hey, just let people do what they want, don't put any limits on them. Well, who is going to be most likely to be able to do that sort of thing, right? It's certainly not going to be the people who are struggling to afford their next meal. They're not going to be the ones altering their bodies radically to improve themselves. So I think that one result of this kind of freedom could be a growing just differences in society between levels of people and levels of ability and things like that could have profound consequences for politics, for ecclesiology, things like that.
And you outline for us what we are currently doing that will lead us to value the types of things morphological freedom values. And the first of them is virtual reality, social media, self-projection, a certain type of individualism. So we're going to take this break, and then we'll be right back. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify. Do you think I'm in this book? I almost went right through the break. The producer had a whisper in my ear, it's time for a break. So I am in this book, written by Assistant Professor Jacob Schatzer, professor of associate dean in the School of Theology and Missions at Union University. He has written a book titled Transhumanism and the Image of God. There's so much contained here. It really is a fascinating read. And Professor, I'm sorry I jumped off so quickly on you there. You indicate that there are current practices that serve to convince us about the arguments for morphological freedom. They are virtual reality, social media, self-projection, capitalism, and moral issues. Just say a couple words. I really want to be able to move to the last four chapters of the book, which are critical. What is real? Where is real? Who is real? And am I real? But just a little bit about these ways in which we are tending toward morphological freedom.
One of the things that I try to draw out is that there are things that we do with technology that we don't really think anything about, whether that's virtual reality games or our use of social media, that are actually working with some of the same values that transhumanists use with things like morphological freedom. And this kind of rampant individualism meets technology and things like that. And so I'm not trying to say that this, you know, if you use virtual reality, you're going to become a transhumanist necessarily. But I'm just trying to point out that we might think that we're currently rejecting the logic of transhumanism, but these choices that we make and then these things that we're doing are very subtly changing what we value and changing what we think and making us more like transhumanists in these sorts of values and approaches.
The second step in the logic of transhumanism that you deal with is the hybronaut, that augmented reality favors combining material technology with the biological in an effort not to alter the biological, but to create a cyborg. Say a little bit about that for us.
Yeah, so in these three chapters, I'm kind of moving along a spectrum. I tend to think of it as moving from the biological with slight alterations. That's what we talked about with morphological freedom, to this middle step when you're not just using technology to change the biological a little bit, but you're really kind of creating a new thing, a new hybrid between the two. And then the last stage is the one that we talked about earlier of departing the biological altogether and then somehow achieving digital immortality through mind uploading or something like that. And so this middle step is, again, a connection between the biological body and these sorts of technologies that don't just add on or change a little bit, but actually make a new reality or a new type of being.
And in this area, too, you believe that we're closer to the cyborg than we think, aren't we?
Yeah, well, there are lots of ways that as we mentioned with smartphones earlier, that we're just so immersed in our technology that it's almost like it's become an appendage to us. You know, our smartphones are almost another set of eyes, perhaps, or something like that. And we see this especially with augmented reality, which is fairly straightforward. It's basically virtual reality is entirely a virtual world. The real world is entirely a real world. Augmented reality kind of combines those two by imposing virtual things onto the real world. And so we see this in everything from, you know, the way you can see what a particular piece of furniture might look like in your living room. If you use your smartphone and hold it up using the camera to shoot your living room, you can, you know, place the digital couch where you would want it to be, right? It's augmented reality. It's something that is not real imposed over what is real. And that's a fairly simple, straightforward use of it. But there are more and more ways that the real world and the digital world are being merged. And it's changing the way that we are experiencing the real world. And especially as we see this technology become more common and used in different ways, I think there are going to be more challenges that come along with that beyond just looking at a couch.
Help us to understand the concept of artificial intelligence as you are using it. You write about two general types, narrow artificial intelligence and artificial general intelligence.
Yeah, so when we come talk about these two types of artificial intelligence, the narrow artificial intelligence is basically a robot or an algorithm that is designed to do a specific set of tasks very well. It can be trained to do one thing really well. The general intelligence, the larger type of artificial intelligence, is still one that scholars are disagreeing on how possible it is or when it will come into being fully. But this is a type of intelligence that would be able to move across vastly different types of things. So it's not a robot that can do yard work, right? That would be a narrow artificial intelligence. You know, there are robots that can mow your grass, right? They'll just go out on a timer and they'll mow your grass. That's narrow artificial intelligence. This broader type would be a robot that, or an algorithm that would be able to teach itself not only how to deal with lawn repair, but might also then learn how to drive a car and maybe learn how to do taxes, just like a broader range of things that an artificial intelligence would be able to teach itself to do, something that would more resemble human intelligence, which spans across various fields and can do remarkably different things.
And you raised the concept already, but if you can say just a little bit, and we'll move into the last four chapters here, about mind uploading, what really is involved there and what might that mean for the future, and it raises a lot of problems.
Yeah. So this idea of mind uploading then is kind of the furthest step away from the biological. It's leaving the biological altogether. And this is also the one that requires the most speculation because it's still pretty far out. We're not sure what the possibilities might be or how it might be. But really, what I try to highlight is that we're already putting so much of ourselves into the digital realm through social media, through facial recognition technology, all sorts of things like that, that's being put into the digital realm. That in many ways, some scholars would argue that we're already creating mind clones through these practices. And it begins to make us ask questions about why would this be a good thing, right? Why would leaving the biological behind, why do we think that would solve some of our problems? What kind of a view of the body does that promote and things like that?
As we move then into the final phase of the book, a really important part of it, maybe the most important, tell us a little bit, kind of an overview of what it is you are presenting when you write about what is real, where is real, who is real, and am I real?
Yeah, so what I'm trying to do then in this part of the book, in the first part I'm kind of walking through transhumanism and the values of transhumanism and then trying to show ways that we are tending in that direction. And then in this last part I kind of flip it the other way around and look at that simple ways that we can see technology changing us. And so in the chapter, What is Real?, I'm looking at notions of experience, what counts as an experience, and especially highlighting issues related to virtual reality, changing the way we think about what reality itself is. And then I move on and talk about how technology impacts the way we think about places, and especially the place where we are, where we live, right? And the way it shapes what we think about, what it means to be present somewhere, to be part of a place, a community. In the chapter on who is real, I highlight then, well, what about relationships? How are relationships changing? How are we changing not only how we relate to one another through technology, but also what counts as a relationship, right? There are studies about relationships between humans and robots and how, especially in care for the elderly, companionship robots that can replicate conversation and make people feel like they have a connection to someone? Are these relationships, right? So beginning to look at that question. And then finally, this question, am I real? Just which is kind of maybe a bit of a stretch. I think we're all pretty confident that we're real, but using that question to get at this notion of what does it mean to be a self? What are we trying to do as we seek to be real people, real selves, in relationship with others, in relationship with God, you know, living a life that's responsible to the calling of God?
Thank you. That was excellent. The title of the book is Transhumanism and the Image of God. Transhumanism and the Image of God. As you can see, there's so much more. Let's go back then a little bit to each of them then. In terms of what is real, you point out about how so many things are changing with regard to medicine and to doctors and and the examples you give also about consider how keyboards have affected the practice of handwriting and how that changes what we notice and what we write. Many of us, myself included, made the shift to typing as early as we could in school because of the promise of increased efficiency. Handwriting can be strange and efficient. I didn't realize that till about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe it's a little bit longer than that, when one of my nieces, I find out, didn't know how to write. You know, so to me, it was so different when I was in school, and I'm certainly much, much, much older. It was like handwriting was so very important because it revealed so much of yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that what we see again, what I try to do here is tie to something that we've already seen happen. And so I opened the chapter talking about medicine, like you talked about, and just how technology in the practice of medicine has increased layers between the person providing care and the person needing care, right? And oftentimes people feel like the relationship, like they're just treated not even like a human because of all of just the barriers between the human doctors and the human patients, right? Because of all the technologies that can get in the way. And now those are certainly good tools, right? That can do great things, and medicine can do amazing things. But we still have to remember that there's something about the way that we use those that also changes that experience. And so I kind of use that as a jumping off point to get into some of these other things that you mentioned, like typing and like how that impacts writing and thinking about that, but also specifically focusing in on virtual reality and the way that, especially as virtual reality gets more more realistic and more immersive, we're able to see it being used therapeutically, especially in issues related to PTSD, but also ways that if it's able to shape people for good, it's also able to potentially manipulate and shape us for bad as well. And so just drawing up these ideas of what counts as experience, what is real, yes. and who is it that we're being made to be like.
And this part of the book deals a whole lot about the future of Christian discipleship. You write, taking Christianity seriously and taking discipleship seriously means looking carefully at how new technology might shape us in ways that are opposite to the ways the gospel is meant to shape us. In order to use virtual reality technology well, we must reflect on what Christianity has to say about reality in the body. In considering what is quote-unquote real and what is important, Christianity is not silent, but provides a baseline of the importance of bodies for human beings. Our understanding of what it means to be human must be rooted in embodiment, because the incarnation affirms embodiment. The Christian doctrine of the incarnation creates the foundation for the importance of physical presence with one another as disciples. Our anthropology, our understanding of what it means to be human, takes clearer shape when built on the foundation of the incarnation and the central message of the incarnation, God with us, emphasizes embodiments and presence. Say a little more. I want people to understand that the first part of the book is fascinating, but it does, the real importance doesn't come until we make that connection with Christian discipleship.
Yeah, so one of the issues that I try to draw out with this notion of experience and with this notion of virtual reality is that there might be some promise that this holds out, and there might be an entertainment value, and in some cases there's certainly a therapeutic value that we're able to see. But the idea that virtual reality is something that we should want to spend more and more time in, and that maybe the hope of the future is to be able to exist in a virtual reality, actually flies in the face of the story that we're told in Scripture, which is that it is not an escape from embodiment that we hope for, but rather a fulfilled embodiment that we hope for. So rather than filling our lives with virtual reality and seeking to escape our bodies, we should rather be embodied and be in community and seek our flourishing there. So I don't mean to draw out and say, you know, virtual reality in and of itself is a sin or something like that, so much as I'm trying to highlight that these technologies do guide us along in certain directions, and sometimes we have to stop and say, hold on a second. Right. I'm okay with this aspect of this technology, but I don't want to go in that direction. And I guess part of me just fears that our theological formation is becoming so weak that for many Christians, it might be news that the body is a good thing, right? And that's right. Certainly something that Christ shows us in taking on flesh.
Right, you write that virtual reality may give us novel experiences, but it cannot solve the alienation that we feel. One way that we see God repairing the alienation brought about by sin is through the body of Christ, the church. Then, what is real? You point out that how important it is that there is a loss of place that we are feeling in the Christian stories. Placemaking practices, one way to resist the loss of place in modern life is to attend Christian placemaking practices. The God has made creation to be a home for humans, so humans should be concerned with all of it, even outer space.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the things that can happen with technology is first of all, virtual reality, we can just seek to exist in these placeless places, but also just with the way that our society is developing, is many places are just looking more and more like one another, right? You can land in a Walmart almost anywhere, and you can find what you need to find. And there can be some good to that, right? But there's a loss there, and we can forget that part of the beauty of God's creation is the variety of places that he's created, the variety of people that he's created, and then the way that he's called those people to cultivate those places uniquely, to make those places home. And so what I try to draw out here with this idea of where is real is that we don't want to lose this sense of place. We don't want to lose this practice of homemaking in the deep sense of homemaking, of making our places a place where we can rest and we can invite others into the rest. That in Scripture, rest is a metaphor for salvation, right? The salvation that God promises. And so the idea that virtual reality or that globalization will just make places more and more interchangeable is not a good thing. The good thing is that we're in unique places and we can make those places good.
And we can expand the notion of church by considering what the church does. One way of looking at this issue, you write, is that the church exists to carry out Jesus's final command to his disciples, go therefore and make disciples of all nations. We have 1 minute before we need to take our next break, but the next question is deals with who is real, and this begins talking about robots, and we've talked a little bit about them, and you write that the question is not whether they can perform dangerous or self-difficult tasks, but whether they can develop the capacity to appear to care, to love, to be in relationship. On the other hand, there is a question of what these sorts of changes will mean for human understanding and performance of love. And you begin by writing that our definitions of relationships, companionship, and friendship are changing because we have experiences with technology that seem to require relational categories, but at the same time don't fit in existing categories. Robotic technology has transformed our views of relationship at different stages of life. So we're going to take this our final break, and we'll be back about the book, Trans and the Image of God. Welcome back to the final segment of our program with Professor Jacob Schatzer talking about his book, Transhumanism and the Image of God, subtitled Today's Technology and the Future of Christian Discipleship. And we began by talking about reality, four segments. We haven't reached the last one yet. What is real? Changing notions of experience. Where is real? Changing notions of place. And who is real? Changing notions of relationships. And here talking a little bit about robotics. And Professor has a part in the book here where he talks about Christian themes and practices that have been a part of previous chapters also, but they are the Lord's Supper, the culture of the table, and the concept of the friend. Say a little bit about Christian themes and practices, Professor.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to draw out here with these changing notions of relationships is getting at this these changes that seem to be happening, especially with children and with the elderly, where they're beginning there are products that you can purchase, that will seem to develop a relationship with a child or with an elderly person, perhaps somebody who's alone and lonely. There's one scholar, Sherry Turkle, who's done a lot of research on these robot seals that are sold and used in a lot of nursing homes and that people seem to develop a relationship with that seems to have a positive effect. And what I try to draw out is that we need to be very careful about this idea of pushing off the relationships, especially relationships with people who are on the margins, whether that's poverty or health or age, rather than pushing those relationships off to relationships with robots, we should look at Christian practices that remind us that actually God calls all of us together in the body of Christ. And it's that's the picture that we have with the Lord's Supper, of eating the body of Christ together. There's none that are excluded from that. And if we move from that to kind of a culture of the table more broadly, we see that Christianity is characterized by drawing people in, of home-cooked meals, of eating and drinking together. These things that don't just symbolize a family, but draw people together into a family of sorts. And so these Christian practices remind us that it's not good for the elderly to simply have relationships with robot seals, but rather we need them. We need relationships together with people of all different ages and backgrounds, drawn together through faith in Christ and the body of Christ.
It's interesting you point out that the culture of the table can encourage healthy relationships that make us less likely to need to turn to virtual alternatives. And the concept of a friend, the image of the friend, will serve us well. Another way of looking at these potential virtual companions is to change the question to, is this my friend? Let's talk a little the final chapter, other than the conclusion, is, am I real? And you point out at the very beginning the communication technologies, and they've certainly changed. I've been doing this program for 45 years, Professor. And so you can imagine what I've seen in 45 years. You know, when I was surrounded, the kind of technology I was surrounded with back then and what I'm surrounded with today is just so very different. And you point out that those technologies have shaped and changed the way that people interact with information. In fact, they shift the way our brains work. Tell us a little bit about writing this particular chapter, Am I Real? Changing Notions of the Self.
Yeah, so what I try to draw out here is just how technology has affected the way we think about ourselves. And I walk through the way we're encouraged to construct ourselves through virtual reality, right? We like the idea of being able to create ourselves, and virtual reality encourages that. You can select so many things about yourself and who you are, playing with that idea of yourself is better the more of it you can pick and construct. I also then draw on this idea of presenting the self, which has always been part of human societies, as humans have, you know, selected clothing and things for their appearance to present themselves in certain ways. But social media takes that and ramps it up to a whole new level, where we constantly feel that we need to be presenting ourselves and presenting who we want people to see us as. And it ramps it up to such a degree that brings identity problems along with it. And then finally, managing the self. So we have to manage ourselves. We have to manage our attention and what we do. And we see that this idea of our attention even becomes something that technology companies compete to purchase as different apps seek to direct our attention in profitable ways for certain companies to get us to be interested in products and to buy things and to consume. And so all of these things that circle around who we are, our identities, kind of are taken to different levels with this interaction with technology.
In 2015, you report a Gallup survey. More than half of the iPhone owners said they couldn't imagine life without the device. That percentage would be a lot higher today, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think that's actually one word that I think is helpful for us to dwell on, is that idea of imagine. Sometimes we think of imagine as just like, oh, can you make something up and think about it? But actually, our ability to imagine the future is incredibly important. Imagine in the sense of, what do we want the future to be like? What are the possibilities that the future could be like? And the fact that so many of us today cannot imagine a future without such a device is a lack of creativity at the least, and is sad in many ways. We should be able to imagine life, a flourishing life, certainly without a device that has merely become prominent in the last 10 to 15 years.
And the way that we construct the self today is probably much different than it was in the past. Well, it is, of course, because of technology. And you're right that virtual reality appeals to us in part because of the ability to create ourselves. We make choices that impact who we, quote unquote, are in the virtual world and how others will perceive us. This practice seems innocent and inconsequential in the context of a virtual reality game, but it quietly alters our sense of what the self is and to what degree we construct who we are in the real world as well. That could take us far away from God, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what it subtly tells us is that what's most important about you is who you construct yourself to be. What's most important is what you choose and what you want to make most important. And that's very different from a view of who I am as rooted as my identity as a human person created in the image of God for the sake of being in fellowship with God, which I am able to be because of faith in Christ who died for me and who's shaping me into his image. These are very different ways of thinking about the self rather than I'm not a self. I don't want to construct myself. I want God to construct me. I want God to shape me. That is where hope truly lies. And so these technologies are subtly guiding us away from that truth. And again, it doesn't mean that if we're on virtual reality, we are not going to understand the gospel or something like that. But rather, we have to recognize that the very way that these things work tempts us to not believe the gospel and tempts us to think that this other story is better, and to think what I really need is better technology and the ability to construct myself and go the direction that I want to go, rather than being a disciple, a follower of another.
And you write that virtual worlds give people the chance to try on different selves. A man can live in a world as a woman, an elderly person as a youth, or a white person as a minority. And then you have this quote from Peter Novak: technology is enabling and accelerating individualism on every level. It's also lessening our dependence on social institutions such as marriage and religion by allowing us to seek out and form our own social circles more tailored to our own interests. So one begins to wonder if we're not true, have not been able to understand the person that God created us to be, and we're trying to make ourselves that something is maybe far from that, what the consequences are.
Yeah, well, I think one of the sets of consequences of this is that social media and technology gives us the sense that we're connected to such a greater number of people and a greater variety of people. But actually what social media tends to do is it filters who we experience and who we interact with. We tend to, and this becomes most obvious during political election seasons, the people that social media tends to put in front of us are either the people that agree with us, so we'll be really excited that we see someone who agrees with us, or the people who so vastly disagree with us that we're just going to get angry and start an argument, right? It tends to cordon people off into these groups, and so we think that we're experiencing the world at our fingertips through social media, but in reality, we're experiencing a very small slice of it that's profitable because it engages our interests and our attention. That a company then turns around and tries to use for their own good, not ours.
And presenting the selfie, right, while virtual reality encourages self-construction, social media technology prioritizes self-presentation. Social media seems to expand the opportunities for self-expression, but in fact limits and confines. How does it do that?
Yeah, well, it makes certain types of things more important than others. The types of things that are easy to share and that are easy to present, right? And so it makes you also constantly able to be presenting yourself. If you always have your phone, you can always take a picture, you can always post, and so you begin to think about your life in the sense of, okay, well, what should I order at this restaurant? To make it a more interesting post. In fact, I just saw an article, I think it was yesterday, on the New York Times on the website about how this practice is ruining honeymoons because there are couples who are so obsessed with getting the perfect honeymoon photos that they're spending, you know, all day trying to research where to eat so they can take a good picture of a dish or right. When to be at the beach for the perfect sunset photo. And they're ruining the time that they're supposed to have together because they want to post.
Mm. And you point out the social networks also encourage conformity, that there's a pressure to present on one hand yourself in ways that are appealing to certain other people whom you want to impress, but on the other hand, to present yourself in ways that conform to the interests and prejudices of the companies that run them.
Yeah, absolutely. There are all sorts of things like this that filter and push certain types of experiences and certain types of presentations because they're the ones that work. They're the ones that get attention. And then you also have the issue of people, you know, feeling that so much of their self-worth is tied up with how many people like their post or share their post. And so you not only have this this push to present yourself, but then you're tying yourself to the opinion of so many other people. And we see this with children especially. I mean, the bullying, for instance, has always been an issue, right? I'm sure, you know, your listeners of all ages will be able to think of bullying in their past. But it's only recently that we've seen bullying taken to the extremes that it's been taken to, partly because of social media and because kids can never get away from the bullies anymore. They follow them home through the their computers and through social media. And it's this kind of environment where people are seeking to understand who they are and what it means to be human and who they are as an individual. And it's just such a difficult environment to navigate.
What does it mean to manage the self?
Yeah, so this idea of managing the self, I'm trying to get at the fact that we need to especially manage our attention. We need to manage ourselves, what we're paying attention to. And there's a scholar named Tim Wu who has written this book called The Attention Merchants, where he talks about the attention industry and basically points out that many of these technology companies essentially exist to try to grab your attention, whether it's a game or a social media app or whatever else. They want to grab your attention because they can then sell your attention to advertisers or whoever else. And so part of what we find ourselves needing to do is manage that, manage our attention, manage not only who we're presenting ourselves to be, but what we are attending to and what we're thinking about.
And you write that Jesus is saying that as we seek to develop ourselves, we should pursue humility. That is the self-development, the self-construction that we need if we have the kingdom of heaven in view. Amplify on that for a little bit.
Yeah, so I think when we look at I think it's Matthew 18 that I'm drawing on there at that point, and Jesus is saying who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, right? So if we're going to be seeking self-construction or self-presentation, it seems like maybe being the greatest in the kingdom of heaven would be a standard, right? So Jesus is saying who is the greatest, and he says the greatest is the child. He says, truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. And then he says, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And it's these stories, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised, right, that what Jesus says flies in the face of what our culture is doing and pushing us towards. But this simple story to me points out how wrongheaded our notions of self-creation and self-development are. Jesus is saying we should pursue humility. If we want to develop ourselves, we should be humble. That's what self-development, self-construction is, if we have the kingdom of heaven and its values in view.
And the final chapter is a very important one, too. As you point out that you dealt with a variety of themes and practices and images from the Christian tradition that serve to form us to resist some of the ways that technology might shape us, and that sharing a meal together isn't quite an ancient Christian practice, but it is one that has deep Christian roots and connects various elements of the past few chapters. And so there are four aspects of an ideal meal that might form us in certain values and perspectives. Tell us a little bit about those four ideals.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to do in this last chapter is kind of give us an image that can hold some of these things together in our minds. And I think that the table can serve that purpose. And the first of those ideals is when you think of a really great meal that people are gathering to share, you're probably thinking of a meal where people are bringing food that they've worked to prepare, right? It's not just something that's convenient. You know, it's a very different feeling that you get when someone brings you a home-cooked meal that they've labored over, that you know was inconvenient for them, but their love for you overcame that inconvenience, and they wanted to give you something, right? That's very different than, hey, I rushed by McDonald's and I picked this up for you. That's not very inconvenient. It doesn't communicate the same. So one of the ideals of the table is that we're willing to endure inconvenience for each other. A second ideal is the idea that when we eat together, we should eat thoughtfully, right? Being mindful of the needs of others, not only thinking about ourselves and what we want, but thinking about others. And then the third ideal being that when we have this type of ideal meal, we're actually engaging with each other. We're engaging with neighbors and friends. Right. We're sharing stories, memories, things like that. Actually, sitting across the table from one another, in the flesh, sharing life together. And that then hits the fourth of the ideals that I draw out, which is that the food's good, but so is fellowship, right? The idea that we are drawn together into a community, not just individuals seeking our own growth and development and construction and presentation, but rather that we really find ourselves in becoming a sacrificial part of this community, and we find ourselves in loving God and in loving others.
Right. And the fourth, that we can pray, and then you suggest small steps. First, work on your framework for thinking about technology. Second, make a list of questions you want to regularly consider. What are your blind spots with technology use, and how can you remind yourself to check them? Third, support movements to make technology less addictive, and that's especially important for children. And fourth, draw some lines, keep social media out of worship. And you write that in the end, our bigger practices and simple steps must all be oriented around a common goal. The Christian life is not something that we make up as we go. Rather, it is a life of following a Savior. Technology will shape us, but we have to notice. We have to ask questions. What are we doing? And what tools actually help us do that? Our guest this evening has been Professor Jacob Schatzer. The title of the book is Transhumanism and the Image of God. Professor, thank you so very much for being with us. There's so much that you've given us. It'd be great to sit in your classroom and learn a lot more.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed our conversation.
All right. Thank you. Bless you and your family.
All right. You too.
Good night. Bye. There's so much there that we can learn, and yet, and being human, he writes, is really about growing and changing. Our interaction with technologies such as Google can change the way that our brains work. And in the end, as we look at the kind of person we have to ask, if we're going to resist, we must do so by focusing on something positive to build, something that will root us and remind us of what it truly means to be human. What kind of humans are we making? Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone. And come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule. And there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something.
From free expert design help to our 100% satisfaction guarantee, everything we do is made to fit your life and your windows. Because at Blinds.com, the only thing we treat better than windows is you. Black Friday deals are going on all month long. Save up to 45% off site-wide, plus an additional 10% off every order at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions apply.
In a world of endless notifications, there could be an important one you're missing. Your kidneys may be signaling an SOS. With high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes, your kidneys could be warning you of early signs of damage, which may put you at higher risk for events like heart attack or stroke. But there's a simple test that can help spot a hidden signal. Ask your doctor about a urine test called UACR to help detect kidney disease and heart risk early. To learn more, visit detectthesos.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.